Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the latest shooting at Fort Hood, Texas, that has left four people dead, including the gunman, and 16 others wounded, three of whom are critical. Joining us is Kayla Williams, the author of a new book about dealing with post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, from military service in Iraq. Plenty of Time When We Get Home, Love and Recovery in the Aftermath of War. She served in the U.S. Army for 5 years as an Arab linguist, including a year in Iraq with the 101st Airborne Division. And we will discuss this tragedy and its impact on military families, as well as examine the links, if any, between violence and PTSD. Then we'll examine the details of the Supreme Court ruling overturning limits on campaign funding in McCutcheon versus the FEC with Jessica Levinson, a professor at Loyola Law School, who has an article at the Los Angeles Times, Supreme Court Ruling, As If We Don't Have Enough Money in Politics Already. We will discuss what partisan advantage might come out of the ruling in this case that was brought to the Supreme Court by the Republican National Committee and assess how many average citizens in this country can afford to give the low end $5,200 to a candidate, let alone the millions now allowed to candidates, parties, and political committees. Then finally, with the American who spied for Israel, Jonathan Pollard, now at the center of a storm over who is scuttling the Israeli-Palestinian peace talks, we will speak with M.E. Spike Bowman. He was, at the time of Pollard's arrest and trial, the liaison officer for the Department of Defense to the Department of Justice and the coordinator of an investigation into the extent of Pollard's damage to the American intelligence community. We will discuss comparisons of Edward Snowden with Jonathan Pollard and why it is that Pollard is a hero in Israel. And joining us now is Kayla Williams, who served in the United States Army for 5 years as an Arab linguist, including a year in Iraq with the 101st Airborne Division. She is a member of the Army Education Advisory Committee, a fellow with the Truman National Security Project, and a former member of the VA Advisory Committee on Women Veterans. Her books include Love My Rifle More Than You, Young and Female in the U.S. Army, and her latest just out is Plenty of Time When We Get Home, Love and Recovery in the Aftermath of War. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kayla Williams.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
And this latest shooting in Fort Hood, Texas, by a soldier who killed three people and wounded 16 others before committing suicide. Apparently three of the 16 are in critical conditions. And ironically, of course, he bought his 45 caliber handgun at Guns Galore, the very same gun shop where the Fort Hood killer, Major Nadel Hassan, purchased the firearm which he used to kill 13 people back in 2009. So obviously this is a horrible trauma for this already traumatized military base, but the issue of PTSD is coming up in all of the press reports. And your book, your latest book, Plenty of Time When We Get Home, Love and Recovery in the Aftermath of War, is about dealing with PTSD. In this case, it was your husband who was severely wounded in Iraq, and he had a long recovery. And this is a very powerful and intimate portrait of what it's like for a family to deal with this issue. What do we know about PTSD in this case of this shooter whose name is Ivan Lopez?
Well, I don't know anything on a personal level. All I know about this particular individual is what's been in the popular press. And what I've seen and heard so far is that he was getting treatment for some sort of mental health conditions, possibly including depression, and that he was being evaluated for PTSD. But my understanding from what's been released to the media so far is that he did not have a specific PTSD diagnosis. And I do think it is worth noting that the link between PTSD and violence is weak. There is some evidence that people with PTSD are more likely to engage in kind of impulsive aggression, maybe intimate partner violence, but the type of premeditated and extreme cases of violence like what we witnessed yesterday, that is not linked to PTSD. And so I really want to urge people to not develop some, you know, deep fear that all veterans are I've seen headlines as bad as ticking time bombs, and want to remind people that overall, in fact, all people with mental health conditions are more likely to be the victims of violence than the perpetrators of violence.
So according to the Army Secretary, John McHugh, Ivan Lopez served for 4 months as a truck driver in Iraq in 2011. That was after most of the combat was over. And his records show no wounds, no direct involvement in combat, or any injury that might lead us to further investigate battle-related TBI, traumatic brain injury. But nevertheless, Lopez apparently self-reported that he was suffering from traumatic brain injury.
That's something that is frequently underdiagnosed and underreported. People can sustain traumatic brain injuries from any number of things, including car accidents or falling off of a structure or vehicle, or being exposed to a blast injury where the shock wave from an explosion can violently shake your head back and forth and rattle your brain around inside your skull. But if you don't show enough symptoms to get screened and diagnosed at the moment, there may not be anything in your records to demonstrate that you were exposed to a traumatic brain injury. The military has been working very hard to do a better job about diagnosing traumatic brain injuries and pulling people from the fight if they have been exposed to a mild TBI to give their brain a chance to heal and recover. But there are a lot of challenges when you have a highly motivated population like soldiers who don't want to leave their comrades. So some will actually try to hide exposure to mild traumatic brain injuries and not report them because they want to be able to stay there and continue to serve alongside their comrades in arms.
Again, I'm speaking with Kayla Williams, who served in the U.S. Army for 5 years as an Arab linguist, including a year in Iraq with the 101st Airborne Division. She's a member of the Army Education Advisory Committee, a fellow at the Truman National Security Project, and a former member of the VA Advisory Committee on Women Veterans. Her books include Love My Rifle, More Than You, Young and Female in the U.S. Army, and her latest book just out is Plenty of Time When We Get Home, Love and Recovery in the Aftermath of War. So, of course, in your case, your husband had severe traumatic brain injury. He had a piece of shrapnel that went through the back of his head right through and exited out above his eye, I believe, on his forehead.
Near his right eye, yeah.
Yes. So that couldn't be more hideous. And I know when we last spoke, you said when you looked at the x-rays, you couldn't believe that anybody could survive. Obviously, this fellow Ivan Lopez didn't have anything similar to that. So how do you assess, since the brain is so mysterious, how do you assess and aggregate the degree of TBI, traumatic brain injury?
My understanding is that brain injuries are categorized by the severity of the initial injury as either mild, which is basically a concussion, moderate, or severe, and all penetrating brain injuries are automatically categorized as severe. But interestingly enough, there's so much that researchers still don't know about how the brain works. There can be tremendous variation in recovery despite the severity of the initial injury. So my husband sustained a severe brain injury penetrating that was very, very severe. The neurosurgeon thought that he would never be functionally independent, that he might never walk again, but he was walking within a couple of days, and over a period of about a decade, he regained a tremendous amount of cognitive function. It took 6 years for him to be able to read a book again cover to cover, but today he's recovered enough that he's actually started going back to college. And for people who sustain mild traumatic brain injuries or concussions, my understanding is that about 85% all of their symptoms resolve completely within a few months. But for about 15%, there can be lingering symptoms that range from memory problems to anger control problems, difficulty controlling impulses, and a variety of other things. So it's really difficult to know, based on the initial injury, how somebody's long-term prognosis might actually be. And there is also, if you followed the news about football players, American football players, there's a growing amount of evidence that repeated mild brain injuries, repeated concussions, can have a cumulative effect that's extremely deleterious.
So just turning back to Ivan Lopez, the 34-year-old specialist who'd served 4 months in Iraq and was undergoing treatment for mental health issues. He had self-reported. Apparently he was being treated with Ambien. He had sleep problems, etc. He was married with a young child living near the post in Killeen, Texas. He had served in the Puerto Rican National Guard and spent 13 months in 2007 in the Sinai Peninsula with peacekeeping units. And according to Sergeant Major Nelson Bigas of the Puerto Rican National Guard Command, that he knew Lopez during his 17 months training at Fort Hood, and later in the Sinai described him as one of the best soldiers we had in our infantry. But he's also driving a truck. Now, is that some kind of indication of any kind of demotion, or is it not to suggest that not driving a truck is a worthy occupation?
I cannot guess without having access to his personnel files, but if, as you say, he initially served in the National Guard and then switched to the regular Army, he could have chosen to change jobs when he made that switch. And I have no idea.
So,
if you switch from one type of service to another, you may choose to change jobs while making that type of change.
So, given that he was able to purchase these guns off base, he lived off base, and it's relatively easy to purchase firearms in Texas.
In America.
And in America in general, yes. And we won't get into that sad subject, but it is a little bit of a bitter irony that it's the same a gun store, Guns Galore, where Major Nidal purchased his firearm that killed 13 people a couple of years ago and wounded considerably more. What are the rules about bringing firearms onto, private firearms onto bases?
There are very strict regulations about military-owned weapons. Those are always locked up in an arms room, and I am not up on the current regulations about privately owned weapons. I'm just not aware of the current regulations on them. I did read a report a couple of years ago that I thought was interesting, saying that Congress had recently passed a law that commanders in the military were no longer authorized to talk to troops within their command and offer them the opportunity to lock up their privately owned weapons in the unit arms room if the commanders were concerned about the mental health of their troops, and that could be worth re-examining as a policy.
Well, that sounds like one of those laws that the NRA put through, you know.
It certainly does, doesn't it?
The idea that the military officer has no right to talk to subordinates about the use of their private firearms. Also, it does lead you to this extraordinary contrast between the military that has lethal weapons under lock and key and civilian outside the base. It's like a free fire zone. I mean, that's pretty bizarre, isn't it?
I mean, my family has made the decision to not keep a weapon. And as an American, I do believe that we do have a constitutional right to own firearms, but since I have two small children, it has been our decision that for the safety of our household, it is better to not have weapons in the house.
But just in general, the idea that outside of a military base, you can have weapons, you can carry them, you can conceal them, you can buy ammunition, you can buy any amount of guns, but on a military base, you have really weapons under lock and key, and yet the Congress passes a law suggesting that military commanders don't have the right to insist on their subordinates basically having oversight over their use and carrying of private firearms. I guess it's something we're going to have to look into, this business of off base and on base. But you would think, I guess you don't. Do you go? You would go through metal detectors, wouldn't you? Every time you come in and off.
No.
You don't.
No, you drive. You drive through, but a car to you can't.
Right.
You drive a car through the main installation gate, but I don't. Again, I cannot tell you what the regulations are about about privately owned weapons on bases. I don't have them memorized.
And presumably, you know, as you just pointed out, there are a lot of places on a car where you can hide a weapon. So, you know, it's not like getting aboard a plane. So I take it that this is something that is going to come out, don't you think, in the after-action reports about what happened here? It certainly sounds like this law that was passed by the Congress, removing authorities of commanders to police the use of private firearms, that might get a second look, don't you think?
I certainly think it is worth considering, especially since another problem that the military is battling is suicide, and firearms are a lethal means that are frequently used in suicide. And so being able to help remove that as a method from people who are struggling would be a potential avenue that's worth exploring.
Well, Kayla Williams, just in the last minute or so, though, I want to get back to what you said earlier about the very tenuous connection between violence and PTSD, you know, and that connection is being made that, you know, people who are suffering from PTSD, they may be violent in a minor sense amongst those, you know, in families. And I take it in your husband's long recovery, you had a number of incidents where you had to deal with his...
impulsive anger, yes.
Yes, but, you know, this cannot and should not be a kind of, an excuse or a reason for people to start making that connection, which unfortunately some in the press are doing.
Right, and I think that does a real disservice to veterans and to everyone who is struggling with mental health concerns. It is worth noting that PTSD can result from any number of traumas aside from combat. It can result from being the victim of violent crime, from being in car accidents, from experiencing natural disasters, Hurricane Katrina or something like that. So I really want to remind people that just because somebody has post-traumatic stress disorder, that does not automatically make them a threat. It is a very manageable condition with evidence-based treatment. And the other really important message to put out is that people who are struggling should seek help because there are very effective means of treatment. Veterans in crisis can call 1-800-273-TALK and press 1 for 24-hour assistance. The Veterans Crisis Line is also available online. And any of your listeners who are struggling with mental health concerns or trauma, perhaps hearing the news about this shooting has brought up traumatic memories for people. Anybody who's struggling should reach out and ask for help because there are evidence-based forms of treatment that can help, and no one should be suffering alone.
And, of course, in this case, it may be all these reports are quite misleading about PTSD. There may well be a whole other psychological profile involved in what led this Ivan Lopez to do what he did.
And we simply don't know. It's too soon to tell.
Right. But, I mean, it's fairly likely, isn't it, that there are other factors involved. If there is no evidence that he had PTSD and he self-reported, it may be a case of either misdiagnosis or not sufficient diagnosis.
I mean, I think that most people have a deep feeling that for somebody to commit a mass shooting is an indication of some profound disturbances.
Sure. Well, Kayla, just give us out that number again, you don't mind.
The Veterans Crisis Line is 1-800-273-TALK, and veterans can press 1. And definitely I would urge any of your listeners who are feeling that they're in crisis to seek help because there are effective forms of treatment and nobody should be suffering alone.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Kayla Williams.
Thank you for having me on. Have a good evening.
You too. Again, I've been speaking with Kayla Williams, who served in the U.S. Army for 5 years as an Arab linguist, including a year in Iraq with the 101st Airborne Division. She's a member of the Army Education Advisory Committee, a fellow at the Truman National Security Project, and a former member of the VA Advisory Committee on Women Veterans. Her books include Love My Rifle More Than You, Young and Female in the U.S. Army, and her latest book just out is Plenty of Time When We Get Home, Love and Recovery in the Aftermath of War. We're going to take a brief station break and be back looking into the details of the Supreme Court's ruling in McCutcheon versus the FEC.